there is one thing about having a collection of 5,000 hours of audio recordings that you can listen to. They're not necessarily that easy to use. What we try and do is make these recordings accessible. And that means a few different things. One of them is making the audio tapes themselves available online so people can download them freely anywhere in the world and listen to them for themselves.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center. As part of the annual Festival of the Book, we are delighted to participate in the presentation of a new volume produced by Miller Center scholars. The title of the volumes are The Presidential Recordings of Lyndon B. Johnson, Toward the Great Society, February 1, 1964 to May 31, 1964. It's humbling to think that just three months of conversations would fill all these new volumes that are being produced by our scholars. To run the program this morning, David Coleman, who directs the Presidential Recordings Project at the Miller Center of Public Affairs, will moderate. As a scholar and a teacher in the History Department at the University of Virginia, David Coleman specializes in nuclear and defense policy, U.S.-European relations, and Cold War history. David Coleman was educated at the University of Queensland in Australia, earning his bachelor's and PhD down under. David Coleman joined the Miller Center faculty in 1999, and he will introduce his colleagues, Gian McKee, David Shreve, and Kent Germany. Please welcome David Coleman.
Thank you, George, and thank you all for being here. We appreciate you coming along to listen to a little bit about our work. Before we get started, there are, of course, a few people to thank for getting something like this rolling with these volumes. There are some people and organizations that really make our work possible. First and foremost amongst those is the Miller Center itself. This program is unique in the nation. There's no one else doing these recordings as systematically as we are. And the Miller Center has been very supportive over the last decade or so of our work, and we very much appreciate that. These particular volumes and some of our current work is sponsored also by what the acronym is the NHPRC, which is the National Historical Publication and Records Commission, which is an agency of the National Archives, and we're very appreciative for them for partially funding some of our work. There are a few people whose names are in these books who are not here today, and one who is here today who is not actually speaking. Timothy Naftali and Ernest Mayer, the general editors of our series currently, of these volumes. And Timothy Naftali, of course, was the previous director of the Presidential Recordings Programs, now the director of the Nixon Library. Ernest Mayer is an historian at the Kennedy School in Harvard. We have here in the back Pat Dunn, who is an associate editor of these volumes. Pat has listened or read every word, every period, every comma of these volumes, often many times over, and she's really our quality control that makes sure that what we put on the paper and what we put out is really what we mean to say. In his 1965 book, in the second in his series called The Making of the President, Teddy White, or Theodore White, described a meeting in July 1964 where he talked about LBJ and Robert Kennedy. This was the meeting where LBJ told Bobby Kennedy that he was not going to be the vice presidential nominee for the 64 election. You can imagine this is a fairly awkward moment. White goes into quite a lot of detail about what was the awkward pauses and things like that. And he also says, quite tellingly, that Robert Kennedy was particularly restrained because he knew that Johnson was in the habit of recording. And he could see the recording machine and he could see the recording button being on, and so therefore was being even more careful than he would otherwise have been. There seemed to have been some poetic license in that. There are some details about this little anecdote that White related in his 1965 book that don't necessarily hold up, and as far as we know, we don't have a recording of that meeting. But this was really the first public time that presidents secretly recording the White House is put out in a public forum like that. But it basically goes under the radar. It disappears. And it's not until the Watergate investigation, when the Nixon tapes explosively come out into the public domain, that we find out that there actually have been six presidents since 1940 that had been secretly taping in the White House. And it's thanks to the Watergate investigation, and just as importantly, the National Archives archivists, and in this case, the ones at the OBJ Library who do a fantastic job on this, that these things actually become public as audio recordings. And there is one thing about having a collection of what amounts to 5,000 hours of audio recordings that you can listen to. But it turns out that they're not necessarily that easy to use, which is where we come in. What we try and do is make these recordings accessible. And that means a few different things. One of them is making the audio tapes themselves available online. And so we put them on so people can download them freely anywhere in the world and listen to them for themselves. We also, importantly, make transcripts of these. And these transcripts have annotations and have historical context, and they're all done by trained historians. And that's where these print volumes come in. We've so far published 11 volumes of one form or another with W.W. Norton since 2001. And we put these out with historical context so that readers today can understand what was going on then. And so we can, the scholars are trained to read between the lines and then convey that information to readers and students and scholars today. We're also increasingly moving towards digital output, and we're very happy to be working with University of Virginia Press, Rotunda, who are very quickly becoming the gold standard in digital editions. And we're very excited to be working with them in coming years. We have five more volumes in the works. We have so far published 11 volumes, and then we'll increasingly move towards digital editions. To share some insights and play some clips from the Johnson recordings covered by this volume, I'd like to introduce my colleagues here on the Presidential Recordings Program. I'll just introduce them very briefly. David Shreve in the center is an economic historian. He's an editor and assistant editor of six volumes of the Presidential Recording Series so far. And he's author of the forthcoming book, American Promise, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and the Forging of the Modern American Economy. Kent Germany, closer to me, is the author of New Orleans After the Promises, Poverty, Citizenship, and the Search for the Great Society with the University of Georgia Press. He was for several years a member of the faculty here at the Miller Center, but not so long ago went down to become assistant professor of history and African American studies at the University of South Carolina. And he was co-editor of The Kennedy Assassination and the Transfer of Power, which was the first three volumes of the Johnson transcript series. Gian McKee, on the far end, is the author of The Problem of Jobs, Liberalism, Race, and Deindustrialization in Philadelphia, which will be coming out sometime this year or early next with the University of Chicago Press. And he's been editor of volumes 6 and 7 of the Presidential Recordings of Lyndon Johnson. And he is an assistant professor here at the Miller Center and teaches in the Department of History. There is one other editor of these volumes who is not here today, Casey Johnson, who is a professor of history at Brooklyn College and has been with the program since it began in 1998. He's currently in Israel, so he couldn't get a flight here early enough. But he is author of Congress and the Cold War, and he is also one of the editors of these volumes. And with that, I'd like to pass this over to the editors of the volumes, and they will share some of what their work is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I'm Kent Germany, and I'm one of the editors of this series of volumes. And just to give you a very quick overview of what's going on here in February, March, April of 1964. Just remember that the Kennedy assassination had occurred in late November of 1963. So Lyndon Johnson is still finding his way as president and still balancing the issues of being a Johnson in a Kennedy White House. And so this is a theme that's going to run throughout much of Lyndon Johnson's first 6 months in office. Another issue that's there is, in terms of foreign policy, is that Vietnam is not on the front burner. Vietnam is on a burner, and it's quickly getting hot. And it gets hotter, essentially, by the week. But it's not going to be the defining part of Lyndon Johnson's foreign policy during this period. There are a number of revolutionary movements in Africa, a number of independence movements in Africa that he deals with. There's a riot and a rebellion in Panama that really captures his attention in January and then pushing forward. But the foundation for Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam policies are being laid at this moment, and we'll talk about those in greater detail. Domestically, Lyndon Johnson is wanting to get the Civil Rights Bill pushed through, and he wants to get his war on poverty rolling very quickly after that Civil Rights Bill. What he has done to get those set up is to get a tax cut bill passed, a massive $11 billion tax cut bill. That helps buy off a number of vested interests, including American business leaders who see the tax cut as a good thing. And so there's a lot that's going on that Lyndon Johnson is balancing. I want to get to Lyndon so you can hear him, because he's a sight more entertaining than we are. I think we've chosen some conversations here that give you a sense of his personality and some of his style in the White House. In the first conversation I want to play for you, which is labeled here as Testing Sergeant Shriver, Lyndon Johnson wanted Sergeant Shriver to be his ally and had done a good job of remaining friends with Sergeant Shriver over the years. And he had sent Shriver around the world as the Peace Corps director on a kind of goodwill mission in late January. And so Sergeant Shriver, in late January, arrived back in the country, was ready to report on all the great reception he had gotten around the world for Lyndon Johnson and for the United States. Well, Lyndon Johnson had another job for Shriver. And Sergeant Shriver was married to Eunice Kennedy Shriver. He was the brother-in-law of John Kennedy and of Robert Kennedy, a very important figure that Lyndon Johnson wanted to reach out to. Johnson is wanting Shriver to become the director of the War on Poverty, to head up this effort to eradicate poverty in the United States, to deal with unemployment, to deal with, you know, Appalachian poverty, to deal with inner city poverty. But he's already got this job as Peace Corps, and it's doing very well for Sergeant Shriver. Johnson arranged a press conference on February the 1st of 1964 to announce that Sergeant Shriver was going to direct this war on poverty effort. He didn't quite get this cleared with Shriver beforehand. They had had some conversations and talked about it, but it hadn't been really agreed to by Shriver. So early on this day, February the 1st, Johnson calls up Shriver, says, "I've got this press conference I'm going to announce." And Shriver's like, "What press conference? What announcement?" And so for a couple of hours, they have this back and forth, and Johnson tries to convince Shriver that he can remain the Peace Corps director and take on this other job, and it'll be good for the country, and he appeals to everything. And at one point, he asks him if he had the glands to do it. And Shriver, of course, responds like, "Yeah, I got the glands to do it." And then Johnson went on to sort of explain that there was this procedure when he was younger in Texas where a doctor was inserting goat glands, goat testicles, in men to try to restore virility. So this is sort of an early sort of medicinal treatment for whatever ails you. And Johnson then talks about this doctor to Sergeant Shriver. Well, Shriver finally relents a little bit. Johnson goes and announces that Sergeant Shriver will be directing this, you know, heroic effort to try to eradicate poverty in the United States. But they continue to have conversations throughout the day. And this bit comes in the evening. And this is after the dust has settled and Lyndon Johnson is reaching out to Sergeant Shriver, you know, to make sure everything is okay. Shriver at this point is being considered a front runner for the vice presidential nomination. Lyndon Johnson did not name a VP after the assassination. He would not do so until the Democratic convention in August of this year. Shriver was seen as a front runner, but so was Bobby Kennedy. And Johnson was really concerned about Bobby Kennedy, who was his rival and someone who had strained relations with the president. And so Johnson's going to sort of talk to Shriver here, and they're going to talk about foreign policy. They'll talk a little bit about the war on poverty. They're going to talk about the mistakes the United States had made in Vietnam, particularly assassinating South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem. And they'll talk about the wisdom of running for vice president. In any of these conversations, there may be language that's offensive. So that's your warning.
I don't think he's a man in government as valuable as McNamara.
He's terrific, isn't he?
He just gives you the answers, and he gives you cooperation. He's a can-do fella.
Yeah, right.
He's got imagination and drive, and he's working right now. I don't know where he is, but he's on the job.
Yeah. Now, how is that Vietnam? That's the Gaulle thing. Isn't that a That's really the pain in it.
Well, no, that's all right if we could neutralize all of it, but they don't want to neutralize anything but South Vietnam.
Yeah.
And Soviet not going to let you neutralize North Vietnam, so you're just whistling through your hat. And the only way to neutralize it is to whip hell out of them.
Yeah. Is it going really any better? It looks terrible, the paper.
No, it's. We think it's going to go a little better.
God, terrible.
The last two weeks been better.
The ties out there.
We've assassinated a few people, you know, and that always gives us problems. We went in there and killed them off, and now you see what shape we're in.
I often wonder how smart that was.
That wasn't smart at all. Wasn't smart at all.
That's the CIA business.
Well, it just wasn't smart at all, my friend.
Well, they were better off than what you got.
I attended one meeting and they asked me my opinion. I said, if you boys want to play cops and robbers, why don't you get on television? But let's don't go to doing it with allies, because you take you 6 months to get back where you are now.
Right.
But they want to play cops and robbers, and they have, so. Anyway, that's water over the dam. We got you forward-looking and light, and you're going to look to the future. And you just start figuring out. Get these men on in here and let them listen to the Heller in the gardens and the doctors at Harvard. What was his name I was telling you about a while ago? Galbraith. And then you modernize it and moderate it and get it down to where you can stand on your bone hind feet, where it'll stand up for itself, and get ready to be your witness, and let's start rolling it through, and then I'll lend you Moyers a little bit.
A little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm right there. No.
Formation state, see?
Well, he's been working for you about 100% of the time, I'll tell you that. He hadn't got any delegates in the field for you. He's got more judgment than that. And he hadn't got your name on any tickets because he's got more brains than that. But he's in there swinging every hour, I'll tell you that.
Did you see what I said about the...
Yeah, I saw you eliminated yourself from the race completely. We'll get you back in it, though.
Well, that's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. You just don't go to nominating any candidates. I think a man runs for vice president is a very foolish man.
Yeah.
A man runs away from it's very wise. I wished I'd run farther away from it, and I did.
Well, yeah,
but I never was a candidate for it, I'll tell you that.
That was
and don't you ever be a candidate. Don't let anybody else be a candidate. And tell them anybody that runs for it never gets it.
That was a great decision, though, that day. Before you decided to do that.
Well, you just come on now. We've decided this, and I'm with you till the end, and death do us part.
There's not going to be any.
We're not going to let anybody divide us, so just bear that in mind. And when everybody else has quit you and gone through with you, I'll still be standing there by your side. So let's get going now.
Yes. Okay, thanks very much.
Goodbye.
Well, one of the things that Shriver was talking about here is he had made a statement to the press that he wasn't a good vice presidential candidate, but Bobby Kennedy was. And so Johnson sort of laying on the idea that, you know, don't talk about Bobby being a good candidate out in the press. This next thing deals with a civil rights issue, this conversation. And the Civil Rights Commission was something Lyndon Johnson was very proud of. This is one of the cornerstones of the Civil Rights Act of 1957, an act that Lyndon Johnson's mastery of the Senate helped push through. He, as president, had to fill two positions on the Civil Rights Commission, two people that had retired. And he wanted to fill it with an African-American and with a moderate Southerner. He's going to end up filling it with Eugene Patterson, the former editor of the Atlanta Constitution. He's not going to get his first choice, which is this conversation that I want to play here. This is an attorney from Arkansas by the name of Will Mitchell, and that's an important name to remember. This is Will Mitchell. And Johnson's going to make a number of phone calls on March the 2nd, calling the two senators from Arkansas, asking if it's okay if he makes this offer to Will Mitchell. And then he talks to Wilbur Mills, who was probably the most powerful congressman from Arkansas. And he was a friend of Will Mitchell's. And so Johnson lines up all of these folks before this phone call. And they all say he's either not an enemy of mine and go ahead, or I really like him and go ahead. And so Johnson's got his guy. And the reason that Johnson liked this guy, and this is where politics becomes really sort of funny, this guy had introduced Johnson at an event in Arkansas, and Johnson thought it was the best introduction he'd ever gotten in his life. So flattery will get you things, particularly with Lyndon Johnson in this particular case. And so Johnson's going to offer Will Mitchell a slot on the Civil Rights Commission. He doesn't necessarily think this is a favor to Will Mitchell, who's an attorney who's got to make money in Arkansas. You know, this is the famous place for the Little Rock Nine. And he's predicting all along during the day that Will Mitchell's going to tell him to go to hell and take this job essentially and shove it. And he's not going to want to do it. Johnson says it's an ugly job and it doesn't pay anything. All it does is sort of pay your expenses for when they have meetings. It takes away time from your law practice. So he's not really thinking Mitchell will do it. But then I think he would be surprised if, you know, an attorney from Arkansas turned down the President of the United States. Johnson makes this call to Will Mitchell, picks up the phone, says, how are you doing? He's a little surprised to hear from the president, and then says, Mr. President, I think you've got the wrong Will Mitchell. And what happened was that they got the first Will Mitchell is the wrong Will Mitchell. This guy they first called was a retired person that worked for the highway department. And so Johnson's offering the Civil Rights Commission to a bureaucrat from the highway department in the state of Arkansas. He doesn't have the opportunity to decline the position. Johnson sort of apologizes. They have a nice conversation. Wilbur Mills gets on the phone. Mills claims that he remembers this guy, and they have a nice little conversation. They get the proper Will Mitchell on the phone, and Lyndon Johnson lays out the Johnson treatment in this phone call, and he brings in that most revered Southerner, Robert E. Lee, and compares the decision that Will Mitchell faces to the one that Robert E. Lee faced prior to the Civil War, that we need you in there for the South. We need a good, smart, moderate Southerner to be on the Civil Rights Commission that can sort of talk about the perspective of white Southerners, but also not be this rabid segregationist out there that no one's going to respect. And I'll let Lyndon Johnson roll out some of his theories about Robert E. Lee and about this position. And if you have an issue with infanticide, this analogy that Johnson uses might be a little bit of a concern.
Chief, sir.
All right. Hello. Mr. Mitchell?
Yes, sir.
This Lyndon Johnson?
Yes, sir. President Johnson.
How are you doing?
Fine, sir.
Are you the Will Mitchell introduced me up there at Hot Springs?
I am.
Well, I got a very ugly job I want you to do for me.
I'll be glad to help you, sir.
Well, you can do it, and you got to serve your country. Were you in the service?
Yes, sir.
Well, what, Army, Navy, or Air Force? Well, this is just another service job. I'm here talking to Wilbur Mills, and we've got to have a Southerner. A man that's got ability, and a man that's got composure, and a man's got judgment. We got to have Robert E. Lee and sit on our Civil Rights Commission and give our viewpoint, tell them what's right and what's wrong. Well, I got Dean Griswold of Yale, Dr. John Hanna of Michigan State. These are men that have served before. I've got this vacancy, but I want the vacancy to go to a Southerner that understands Southern life, that understands our viewpoint, that can say to people, I think you're making a mistake, here's what you ought to do, dissent if they need to, but I want somebody that I can be proud of as my appointee that just won't be a plain damned idiot and want to eat a little nigger baby for breakfast, but at the same time will understand how to approach this thing as best it can. Now, these are the top men of the nation, and I just don't want the South to show up with a bastard child. That's that simple.
Well, I
And I just decided that I'll clear this out tonight, and I just got to have you represent the South. Now, you just get Robert E. Lee out, and he left West Point. He left West Point, you know, and said that he had to get out of the Federal Army and go home and look after his people, and that's what you've got to do, because we've got this problem. We got to have somebody that's got judgment, got eloquence, got ability, and that can sit in a room with people, disagree with them, and still without being too disagreeable. And that's what I'm having to do every day.
So that's Lyndon Johnson laying out his strategy. Mitchell's going to eventually turn this job down and is going to go to Eugene Patterson, who was would win the Pulitzer Prize in 1967 for his writing. At this point, I'll pass things over to Professor Shreve, who has an answer to that telephone ad that a current presidential candidate has played, where the telephone rings at 3 a.m. and who answers it and what they do.
Thanks, Kent. I'll actually introduce that phone call and conversation second and go to the April 9 conversation first, signing the Farm Bill. In part because this one, you'll see, dovetails with a couple of the ideas introduced in these previous conversations. What you'll hear is a conversation between Johnson and Larry O'Brien. One of the issues here, and I think you'll get a feel for it, neither of the conversants will really talk about this directly, but you'll get a feel for the way in which Johnson and O'Brien related to one another. Much as Johnson was with Shriver, a Kennedy man whom he hoped to win to his side and bring along and put on the team, you might say the same thing about Larry O'Brien. And indeed, in retrospect, it was probably O'Brien among all the Kennedy folks that Johnson got along with the best early on in his administration. So you'll pick up a little bit of that in this conversation. Secondly, this is about the farm bill that Johnson is trying to pass through the House of Representatives at the time. And like most farm bills that have been considered from the 1930s onward, it's an omnibus bill that has many moving parts to it. It's been told that when FDR introduced his first farm bill, 13 different people drafted the bill, and it showed. Most farm legislation is like that, where it's hard to really follow what it does in all instances, and there's something for the cotton farmers, something for the wheat farmers. There's a food stamp piece in this one, and there's some research grants for tobacco people, and on and on and on. And Johnson has pushed hard on this particular piece of legislation, not because he loves it or because he likes this kind of a bill, and in fact, the following year, he would return to a much simple version of farm legislation modeled after what he saw in the Truman administration under then Secretary of Agriculture Charlie Brannan. But at this time, he sees this as, one, a test for the Democratic Party. It's a Democratic bill. He'll get about 10 Republican votes in the House, from mostly from the Dakotas, who were interested in their wheat farmers there and wanted to go along. But generally, they stack up on party lines here, and Johnson knows that. The other thing that he's interested in here is that Southerners in particular are interested in the cotton portion of the bill, and he feels that this is one way in which he can keep Southerners on the team as he fights for civil rights, as he fights to launch a great society and a war on poverty, because he sees them not only as potential votes in Congress, but as particularly on the War on Poverty and Great Society legislation, as key allies. And he wants to wean them away from their preoccupation with race and segregation and bring them into this discussion in a bigger way. So he wants to use the Farm Bill in that respect. Now, it does ultimately pass, and what we're seeing here is preparations for a signing ceremony. To Johnson's chagrin, he realizes that the cotton interests in the South are primarily textile manufacturers, not cotton farmers. Now, he had a conversation with his friend Dick Russell a couple days before this, in which Russell assures him that, well, it'll be good for cotton farmers too. It's likely to reduce the impact of the synthetics. Jim Eastland down in Mississippi, when he talked about this bill, he always railed against the DuPonts and how they were taken over, and nylon and all the synthetics were going to drive all the poor cotton farmers out of business. And so Russell reminded him of that, and he thought that it would some of the benefits would ultimately trickle down to consumers as well. But Johnson's not terribly convinced by this, and so he feels that it's not a perfect bill, but they've got to have a signing ceremony. Hence his conversation with Larry O'Brien about how to set this up.
Yes?
Larry O'Brien on 90.
Yes, sir. Mr. President, would you consider calling Dick Daley to give him a little thank you on this?
I sure will, and I doubt the wisdom of having all these textile rake-offs in here for this signing.
I didn't know about that.
Well, Jim Eastland proposed we have Cannon Mills textile.
Yeah.
And I told him to let you and Secretary of Agriculture decide it.
All right.
And if I were you, I'd just tell him that it looked like a rake off of textiles, and I'd get every goddamn one Gallus farmer I could. I'd get old E.W. Brooks from Georgia, make North Carolina senators, Mississippi senators, and South Carolina senators, and make them bring a whole bunch of horny-handed sons of toil in here for the picture Saturday. And I'd get to work on it, get Freeman to work on it, tell if he's got one goddamn dirty tobacco-chewing farmer as far as this bill, get him in here. I don't think he has. I think they're all towel manufacturers.
Yeah, I think.
But just tell him that in that kind of language. Can you Irish talk that kind of language? Or?
I've tried it a couple of times. I think I can do it.
All right, well, now you, I don't want you to try it on me. on Freeman, because we blessed for him.
Okay.
I don't want to bleed for him anymore. I'll call Dick Daley in the morning or the first moment I get.
All right. Very good.
All right, now you get that ceremony and let's stack them in.
All right. I will, Mr. President.
You call Freeman right away.
I will.
Now, Adam Clayton Powell, what's that payoff? You got him on 11 o'clock in the morning.
Well, he didn't tell me any of the specifics. He just wants conversation, but I'm going to try and put together all the things that he's interested in.
You just feed me to the wolves and just barehanded, huh?
No, I'll have something for you.
Take my clothes off of him and turn me loose naked into a vulture's hand.
No, all that'll happen on that is that after you talk to him, if we can get him back to Puerto Rico over the weekend, you won't see him for a while.
All right, okay. When are you going to get your poverty bill out?
Tonight.
No. When really? April?
Yeah, we should. We're going over now a schedule that we're going to take up with the leadership on things we think they ought to be moving immediately.
The two things I want to move on is pay and poverty.
Yeah, well, I discussed pay with both Albert and Boggs. And there's a little conflict, as you know, in their view and the
Get a hold of this ambassador to Jamaica and ask him if he's going to underwrite this pay bill, and if so, get the hell to work on it.
The ambassador to Jamaica, William Daugherty, was a former postmaster general, and he was particularly interested in pay raises for the nation's postmasters and postal workers. So that explains that reference. The additional references that I didn't explain to Adam Clayton Powell and Dick Daley, some of you may have figured out on your own, but because this was a Democratic Party bill and Johnson used it in part to weld the party together, he was looking for allies anywhere he could find them, and ironically, it was Daley in Chicago and Adam Clayton Powell in New York City who really did more to pass the Farm Bill in 1964 than any of his other allies. And in fact, in a lot of conversations in the weeks prior to this with Southerners, Johnson pointed out in particular that Clayton Powell was helping him. And, you know, if a guy from Harlem can get behind this bill, why can't you? You know, and he's got nothing. He's got no cotton farmers in his district. So what gives? And it also, when Powell comes in the next day, he's there to talk about an appointment to the Puerto Rico Commission, which not a terribly important appointment, but one that in which he was concerned. But Powell would become an interesting ally over the next year or so. It was his subcommittee that would push through most of the Great Society and War on Poverty legislation, and as such, he would be a very important figure and ally, and Johnson recognized that, and in many ways, they were very much alike in their approach to doing this sort of a thing politically. But he would also become more erratic as the years passed, and he would They're talking about how he would leave for Puerto Rico at this point. He would later sail off for Bimini and would be gone for weeks on end and couldn't be counted on to really do the job as we move into 66, 67, 68. So at any rate, that's what we have there. This next conversation, I think given the recent attention on 3 a.m. phone calls, might be a little illuminating in that regard. Number one, you'll see how mundane these calls can really be. And in fact, there was a Washington Post article a week or two ago that did a pretty good job of surveying the last six or seven administrations and where they have had 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. phone calls. And they went down the line, and you could see that most of them were relatively insignificant phone calls. They didn't call for an immediate decision on the part of the president. Generally, they were just to convey information and let him know that things are being taken care of. You'll see a little bit of that here. The other thing that you'll see is how sleepy and cranky a president can be at 3 a.m. You'll get a little bit of this from LBJ. Word of background, he was at the ranch in Texas. What happens is there's a massive earthquake that hits near Anchorage, Alaska at this time. And to date, it's still regarded as the second most destructive earthquake on record. I think there was one in Chile that surpassed it, but it was wreaked great destruction on Alaska. It was centered on Seward. Effects were felt as far away as the Oregon coast. And so the call that's this 3 a.m. call is about that earthquake and the potential damage and what should be done. It's interesting to note as well that the call doesn't really come into Johnson. He actually makes the phone call. He had awakened with a cold, and once he was up, then somebody who had already gotten word about the earthquake said, well, we probably need to tell President Johnson about the quake, and maybe he wants to talk to Press Secretary Reedy and see what he can do, if anything. Hence the call from Johnson to Reedy a little bit after 3 a.m. Piece of background here that's when you get to the cranky part of the conversation that will help you figure out what's going on. He's at the ranch, and up to this time, he's had really rosy relations with the American Press Corps. They've treated him exceptionally well. There's a show that comes out the next week in which Walter Lippmann, who would become one of his biggest critics on Vietnam policy in 67 and 68, praises Johnson to the skies and goes so far as to suggest that he was beginning to do the kinds of things because of his political approach and his nature and his character that Kennedy could have never done had he lived. It was a pretty bold statement to make this close to the assassination. Dick Russell calls Johnson after that and he says, I bet you're signing over the deed to your TV station right now to Walter Lippmann. It's going to be a Walter Lippmann station eventually. So he's getting good press. The first chink in the armor comes this weekend when he's at the ranch. And what happens is, and it actually happens later on the same day, they're snooping around, they're following his every move, and he's getting a little bit irritated by that. He feels like he's really on vacation and he's not there to do policy, and so they've got no business. But he does invite members of the press later on that day to follow him around. And in what would be chronicled in Time magazine the next week as the Speed and Beer Drive, he's captured riding around his ranch at speeds up to 90 miles an hour, as they put it in Time magazine, with a cup of Pearl beer in his hand, stopping every once in a while so that a Secret Service agent could refresh the cup. Hearst reporter Marianne Means in the back seat, giggling all the way. He stops at a couple points and gets a piglet and brings them in and throws it in the car and to the amusement of the press. He thinks it's a grand time. All the press people along for the ride are having a pretty good time, but it's portrayed in Time as just this kind of a goofy escapade. I think to quote the Time editor, he said something like, give President Johnson a whiff of the spring air in Texas, and he comes on like the cross between a teenage Grand Prix driver and a back-to-nature Thoreau in cowboy boots. So this actually comes after this, but he's beginning to get a little bit miffed by the way in which the press is paying a little bit too close attention to his movements at the ranch. And you'll pick this up in the call. And what I'm going to do, Kent, as well, is there's three sections here. We've edited out some, and I'm going to skip over the middle section if we can.
George? Yes, sir. Any more on the earthquake?
Yes, sir. My reports between defense and White House are slightly conflicting. We won't worry about that. The situation in Alaska is as follows. Anchorage, power and light.
Anything we can do about it?
No, not at the moment. Sylvester at one point had a suggestion to declare a state of emergency, and I said, what kind of a state of emergency? The governor's already declared one. And I don't think he exactly knew what he was talking about. I've asked him to look into this thing and call me back with a clear recommendation. I've already told the press that you've been apprised and have expressed concern and are awaiting further reports. But one of the things that we really have to wait for is nobody is very clear on the effects of this tidal wave, which should be hitting Hawaii right now. They're expecting a 6-foot wave. The problem is what the force of that wave will be. But a 6-foot wave could do a hell of a lot of damage in Hawaii. However, they have been alerted. And they are hoping that the loss will be in life will be very low.
Go to the last section where he starts railing back up just one step. Yeah. There it is, right there.
It's nothing to be concerned about, sir. Not at all.
So they said I was in the area, and that meant I was probably with my big trustee of my fortune. That's the best thing I ever saw a grown man. That's the stories back in Washington papers I got yesterday. They're very concerned. I announced I'd landed in the area, but that meant that I was probably with Judge Morrison, who's a trustee of my fortune. Yeah, a pretty much a chance. I would tell him that there's an area of 40, 50 miles here that includes Cutting Orioles, Stonewall, where the post office is, Johnson City. And they might as well join places. I would like to know that I can leave without calling a press conference. It's just the same as I do when I go out to dinner in Washington. I don't call them. I'm not going to.
Well, whenever there's a little bit of time, I think I can discuss a few steps at night.
Well, they've got these little peepholes with the long-range cameras, and they're peeping around here, and this little UP boy is out here riding up and down in front of the house like a little ass. And I tell UP to try to keep their boys in there. We have to move them all out here.
So he's beginning to be less than delighted with some of the handling of the press. The reference to his fortune probably relates to a series of articles that came out in the Wall Street Journal about a week before this by Lewis Kohlmeyer, in which Kohlmeyer took the first really close look at the Johnson family TV station and how they acquired it and how prosperous the station was. And the intimation in these articles was that they had pulled a lot of strings to make a lot of money, and Johnson was seething at the kind of coverage he was getting. I'll pass it on at this point to my colleague Guillen McKee, and he'll feature a couple of other conversations from this period.
Thank you, David. I want to begin with a conversation that actually has, I think, some at least broad salience to some events earlier in the current presidential campaign, and in particular, the question with the Mitt Romney campaign about his faith, his religion, the way that his status as a Mormon would potentially affect how he would govern. And if you recall, early in the year, Romney made a speech in which he attempted to address that issue. And the press made an explicit effort to compare it to a speech that John F. Kennedy made during the 1960 campaign, in which he went to Houston, spoke before a group of Baptist ministers at a conference in Houston regarding the role that his own Catholicism would play. And in many respects, it did diffuse the issue enough that he managed to squeak through and win the presidential election. The difficulty with the kind of neat, easy discussions and explanations of this issue that you tend to get in popular accounts of history is that there's an assumption that Kennedy makes the speech in Houston and never again shall religion or Catholicism be mentioned in American political life. No. In fact, Kennedy becomes president and Catholicism defines many aspects of his domestic policy. In 1961, it sinks a major aid to public education bill, literally around the question of whether parochial schools are going to get funds from the federal government. Continues with problems with higher education legislation, and even after Kennedy's death, as we'll see here, Catholicism is still an explosive issue in which Southern Democrats, other conservatives, are unwilling to entertain any compromise that would bring any form of federal support to parochial schools. And this is something that works both ways with teachers' lobbies fighting it as well and strange alliances with conservatives. The specific context of this conversation is actually a fight that was going on around the war on poverty legislation, which, as we've already talked a little bit about, is now moving through Congress, now in Adam Clayton Powell's committee in the House in particular. What had happened was that a Democratic Catholic congressman from Brooklyn, Hugh Carey, in alliance with people like Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts, had introduced an amendment to the Economic Opportunity Bill, the authorizing legislation for the war on poverty, to permit one of the titles of the bill to allow funding for remedial education programs to be undertaken in parochial schools. This touched off a major battle in the committee, in the House at large, in which Southern congressmen in particular were threatening to rebel, potentially going to sink the entire legislation. This is one in a series of conversations, which many of them, Johnson is simply livid. He's ready to run Tip O'Neill out of the Democratic Party for this. There are games going on where he thinks O'Neill's actually blackmailing him about closing military bases in Massachusetts. So a whole set of wider issues at play. This conversation is something of an aside, actually, in which Johnson speaks both to how he plans to or hopes to handle this explosive question of religion and the role of the federal government in potentially providing aid to religious groups, but also speaks to how he, in an earlier incident, had diffused the anger of a Southern Baptist leader, recounting a case in which the leader had called at a moment when he, by chance, happened to be swimming in the White House pool with Billy Graham. The conversation speaks for itself, so that we'll go ahead and play it, Kemp.
Mr. President,
yeah.
Thank you, first of all, for that wonderful speech in Atlantic City.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate it. I hope you didn't mind me coming back and mentioning you a little bit. I want to draw a little attention to
you. Oh, not at all. And Mrs. Johnson was just wonderful.
Well, thank you, Frank. Frank, we can't change that bill. We're sent up there. If for no other reason, symbolically, they say the Pope changed it. They're already saying it's a Pope to Spellman to down. I ran into it today at lunch. They've got every man worked up, and it's already, they may have already killed it. I don't know. What we got to do, in my judgment, is this. Shriver is a Catholic, and he's going to administer that bill, and he's going to make no distinction between any city that wants anything approved. He can make them do it, whatever he wants to, or he doesn't approve it.
Yes, sir.
That's number one. Number two, I'll support him all the way, just like we did in the NYA days. We'll make them go through the boards and make them take care of them where they have them. We can even put language in the report that you want in the bill. It'll take care of the same thing. But if we allow these crackpot preachers to get in here and say the Pope has rewritten the bill, and we got a Catholic administering, we got a Catholic writing the bill, and the Rules Committee made him rewrite it, then we haven't got a stinker's chance. We won't get a third of the votes.
We do. That's right.
And now what you got to do is get a hold of Kerry and get a hold of Tip O'Neill and get a hold of Jim Delaney and put a paragraph in that report buried down there where the administrators got to see that the school boards treat every child of every religion, of every race, equally. And then Shriver, under his authority to approve or not approve, can do just exactly like we do now. We won't give a war plant unless they agree not to discriminate. And he can say to them, we won't do this unless you do this for St. Anne's.
Yeah.
Or we won't do this unless you do this for St. John's.
Yeah.
And I've told Walter Jenkins and my folks that, and I told Bob Pogue and Wright Patman, all of them were up in arms today, just moving around there, and I said, now just get the Pope's not coming here to take over yet. Spellman hadn't given any orders, and we're going to work this thing out, and it's going to be the same bill that's sent up to the Hill. It doesn't discriminate against anybody, but we're going to put a provision in the report where it won't be an issue, and Charlie Halleck's promoting all this stuff. He's the one that started it. We're going to do too much for Negroes. He thought that would run the Southerners off,
yes.
And it didn't do it. I went to Atlanta, and I had 600,000, so it didn't make them too mad. Now he's trying to do it with the Pope, and if we get through with the Pope, they'll do it some other way. They're trying to beat this bill and divide this party. Now, we got to be outsmart them. But I'll assure you this, as long as I'm in this office, a Catholic child will be treated the same as a Baptist child.
Oh, heavens, we know that.
I wouldn't have gone on this ticket in 1960, except I wanted to prove that. And I tell them that story about Joe Kennedy taking that plane out to go back on the last time when he shot down. He had a Baptist boy sitting by his side. And they called up here the other day when I gave Shriver a letter to the Pope. And the Baptist, James, who's head of the Baptist in the South, he called up and denounced him. And Bill Moyer's got a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
And Bill said, well, I can't get to him now. He said, he's in a meeting. And they said, what kind of meeting's he in? Said, he's out swimming with Billy Graham. And they said, he is really swimming with Billy Graham? And Bill told him, yeah, and I was. And they said, well, then there must not be much to this Pope story then if he's swimming with Billy Graham. So that's the way we answer him. But don't let them make them fools of us.
Well, Mr. McCormick has told Tip O'Neill and Jim Delaney that under no circumstances must...
Okay, I want to cut that off so we can move on. Just a couple of the references there. Cardinal Spellman was the leading Catholic figure in the United States at this time, seen very in many cases as the voice of the Vatican in the U.S., and quite influential with many of the Catholic congressmen from the urban Northeast as well. Charlie Halleck was the Republican, a Republican congressman from Indiana and the House Minority Leader. So a friend of Johnson's, actually, but also a thorn in his side in many cases in the domestic policy issue in particular of this period. One other anecdote about the swimming. We mentioned the Johnson treatment and the Johnson's use of his physical presence and personality to intimidate people, often in close physical proximity to achieve his own ends. There was a variation of this that involved the swimming pool, actually. First of all, Johnson often swam in the nude as when he invited his guests, so he had that aspect to begin with. He would also position himself in the shallow end of the pool and maneuver the guests into the deep end of the pool, so he's kind of looming over them. So you can kind of imagine whether Billy Graham, you know, allowed this to play out in this particular instance. We don't know the answer to that, but Graham did not walk in water, apparently. We can assume that one. Okay, for the next conversation, I want to turn back to the issue of Vietnam. Kent mentioned that early on, although it's a concern, it's not the front burner foreign policy issue. By the time you get to late May, into the spring of 1964, Johnson is becoming increasingly worried about the problems that are developing in South Vietnam, in the U.S. effort there, which at this point is a fairly extensive advisory position, but not yet mass commitment of combat troops. In late May, he has a number of really soul-searching conversations that are recorded. About the question of what to do in Vietnam, how to proceed, in which he expresses his frustrations, his fears, his sense of really being trapped by this issue, of a situation that he can't see a positive outcome from this. As early as the spring of 1964, he foresees the outcome, yet he feels unable to escape because of the position he's in, because of fears of what had happened to Harry Truman after the fall of China to the communists, the sense that the Republicans would attack him vigorously if they were to pull out of Vietnam. In this conversation, this is part of a much longer conversation, actually, on exactly these issues. He's speaking with Senator Richard Russell from Georgia. Russell was one of the senior senators in the Senate at this point. He had been a friend and political mentor to Lyndon Johnson, really one of the key figures in Johnson's own rise. Johnson had, after entering the Senate, had made an effort to establish a close personal relationship with Russell, inviting him to the Johnson home nearly every weekend for meals. Johnson was single and often a very lonely man. At this point, of course, the Civil Rights Act is moving through Congress. Russell is on the opposite side from Johnson on the civil rights issue. He's leading the Southern filibuster against the Civil Rights Act. So this is a moment in which their relationship is at some level under strain. Yet Russell is also a respected voice in terms of military affairs and foreign policy generally. And Johnson still turns to him, despite the wider context and their changing relationship, for insight, for advice on how to proceed with the Vietnam issue. This is a particularly striking conversation because of a historical reference that Johnson makes and that Russell not only understands, but uses to advance his own position on the current issue of Vietnam. Johnson refers to Ben Milam. Milam was a leader of the Texas Revolution in the 1830s. Milam had been a trapper in Kentucky, had come in as one of the military leaders, and in the winter of 1835, the other leaders of the Texas independence movement had adopted a policy of essentially hunkering down for the winter. Milam argued for a surprise attack on the Mexican forces camped outside of San Antonio, issuing a famous appeal for volunteers who will ride with old Ben Milam. The attack was successful, but Milam died in the attack. And Johnson refers to this. It's a very interesting way, I think, of speaking to Johnson's sense of himself. There are issues of masculinity that arise here that I think are fascinating. Also, the way that Russell understands this relatively obscure detail of Texas history and is able to use it. Speaks to his own sophistication, despite his positions on race, on segregation, his sophistication, his knowledge, his own skill as a politician. And that'll play the clip.
I just don't know. It's a tragic situation. It's just one of those places where you can't win. Anything you do is wrong.
Well, think about it. Call me.
All right, sir. I thought about it. I have worried about it. And I have prayed about it.
I don't believe we can do anything.
Religiously, I have, because it's something that frightens me, because it's my country involved over there. And if we get into there on any considerable scale, there's no doubt in my mind but the Chinese will be in there, and there we'd be fighting a dang conventional war. Against our secondary, potential threat, and it'd be a Korea on a much bigger scale, and a worse scale, because the peculiar physical configuration of Korea made extensive guerrilla fighting impossible. But that's not true over in there. If you go from Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam and bring North Vietnam into it too, it's a mess on earth. The French report, they lost 250,000 men and spent a couple billion of their money and 2 billion of ours down there. And just got the hell whipped out of them, and they had the best troops they had, including practically a division of crack German troopers who were starving and enlisted in the Foreign Legion and went down there.
You don't have any doubt, but what if we go in there and get them up against the wall, the Chinese communists are going to come in?
There's no doubt about
that. That's my judgment, and our people don't think so.
There's no doubt in my mind about it. You'll find Chinese volunteers in there as soon as you get, very shortly after we have active combat units engaged.
Now, Mike writes me a memo, and all he says is that we continue to support the Vietnamese, and that's number one. An end to the reflex of peak and face saving at every essay of De Gaulle's. Well, we've not peaked. We just asked De Gaulle to give us a blueprint, and he don't have it. He just says neutralization, but ain't nobody wants to agree to neutralization. And we ask him who will agree to go with old Ben Milam. We're ready, but he just says, well, we have to continue to maintain our strength and get in a position. But but he's got no blueprint. Three, a realistic facing the fact that we're in this situation without reliable military allies. Well, I know that. Four, an exploration of the possibility of the United Nations or some other arrangement. Well, this is Mike Mansfield, and they won't do a damn thing, even on the Cambodia border. We can't get a majority vote in the Security Council. A willingness to entertain any reasonable proposal for international conferences. Well, we are ready to confer with anybody any time, but the conferences ain't going to do a damn bit of good. They ain't going to take back and give us territory and behave. We tell them every week. We tell Khrushchev. We send China and Hanoi and all of them word that we'll get out of there and stay out of there if they'll just quit raiding their neighbors, and they just say, screw you.
That's right.
So the conferences won't do it. Now, the whole question, as I see it, is it more dangerous for us to let things go as they're going now, deteriorating every day?
I don't think we can let it go, Mr. President, indefinitely.
Then it would be for us to move in.
We either got to move in or move out.
That's about what it is.
Future. You can make a tremendous case for moving out.
Take the Nixon.
Good one for moving in, but
Nixon, Rockefeller
would be more consistent with the attitude of American people and out and their general reactions to go in, because they could understand that. But getting out, even after we go in and get bogged down in there with the war with China, would be it's going to be a hell of a mess. It'd be worse than we are now. To some extent, that's what makes it so difficult. And don't forget that old Ben Milam, the only man, got killed. And he said, who's go with old Ben? He's a great hero, but he got killed.
That's right.
And the old man was killed. And they start off with Ben Milam, which they ain't gonna do to any inside degree. They'll get out, and Ben be killed. It's just a help come on. I don't know. I don't know how much Russia. They won't cause us all the trouble they can, but if there's any truth in the theory that they are really at odds with China, and really is a cleavage there.
I think we'll stop it there because now we're short on time. But one of the things you get with this particular set of volumes is a sense that the key events of the Johnson administration, of the national level political history of the 1960s, are really building to a point where you're gonna see the most important dimensions and developments and trends emerge. You see their roots in really fascinating and illuminating ways through this time period. As Johnson becomes president, gets a sense of the office and of the challenges that he's facing. With that, I think we'll take some time for questions at this point. I believe George is gonna start us off.
Let me start off with asking David Coleman if perhaps as director of this program, you mentioned in your opening comments that there were six presidents who had engaged in recordings of some level. If you could give our friends here an overview of what was recorded, why they did it, what they intended to use these recordings for, and sort of set the context for the presidential recordings program.
Well, there's no single answer for each of the presidents. There were six presidents, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, who recorded. The most famous, of course, are the Johnson and the Nixon tapes, and they're the two biggest collections that there are. Roosevelt started recording because he used to have press conferences in the Oval Office. This was before there was a separate press room and televised press interviews and things like that, of course. And of course, the press were just in there, gathered around his desk during a press conference, and he got a little fed up with being misquoted. And so what he did was had the Secret Service install in the lamps in the desk, on his desk, secret microphones where he could record these press conferences and actually have a record of what was going on, so that if one of the press reporters decided to write something that wasn't true, he would have his own record. Of course, often captured other discussions as well. Forgot to turn it off, captured other meetings and things like that. So the Roosevelt ones, it's a fairly small collection by comparison, and there's a mix of press conferences and things like that, but there's also quite a few other very interesting meetings on there. Truman and Eisenhower collections are much smaller, much harder to work with. Kennedy, as a lot of you may know, started recording about the mid-1962, and you may know about the Kennedy recordings, particularly because of the Cuban Missile Crisis recordings. There were very many, that area was particularly well documented with what was going on at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Johnson and the Nixon recordings, first I'll say too, as far as why Kennedy was recording, there's fairly good evidence that Kennedy was doing it to write his memoirs that he never got to write. There are actually instances where you can listen to Kennedy sitting down the end of the night with a tape recorder and basically dictating what his memoir entry was going to be for a particular event, like after the assassination of GM, for instance. You can listen to him recounting what had happened. You can also hear, while he's in the middle of doing that, Carolyn and John come in, and he plays a little game with them and things like that, and then he gets back on recording, getting back on with presidential business about the assassination of foreign leaders. It's quite a touching quite unusual little episode. Johnson recorded mainly telephone tapes, which is what you've had here. There were some meeting tapes recorded from 1968. There's about 200 hours of those. And then the Nixon tapes were a little bit different. Nixon, by his own admission, was technologically inept. He did not want the power, and his staff did not want him to have the power to turn the machine on and off, because a simple button was something he didn't want to have to deal with. And so he was hooked up to a voice-activated system that was fairly complicated that the Secret Service had installed. There were lights that showed up where he was. The president carries with them at all times a little presidential locator, so that the Secret Service knows where they are, and the recording system was somehow hooked up with that, as well as voice activation. And so Nixon, from the time the system got rolling, you record just about every time he's having a discussion in the room. And you get a lot of very interesting stuff, some not so interesting stuff, some vacuum cleaning. You get all sorts of things. You get everything with Nixon. All of the other presidents were much more selective about what they were recording. And it bears mentioning too, these recordings, if the presidents had had their way, these recordings would never have been public. These were not designed for public consumption. There's only one president, and that was LBJ, who made who said anything about eventually this stuff becoming available, and he didn't want it to come out until 50 years after his death. But all of the other recordings collections were designed to be and considered by the people who made them to be private collections. They were not meant to be made public. And the fact that they are, as I said at the outset, was because of the Watergate investigation, the public outcry at the time. So the presidential recordings program is working across the spectrum of these collections. We've published so far books on Kennedy, Johnson. We have quite a bit of work on the Nixon materials, which we've published online. And so any of these recordings you can actually go and listen to as well. We have transcripts and we have clips like this that teachers and students and scholars can actually use through the web.
I am told that be, unfortunately, that we are out of time and have to bring this to a close. So let me ask our audience to thank Ian McKee, David Shreve, Kent Germany, and David Coleman for this fantastically interesting presentation.
I will just say, if anyone does want to ask any questions, we'll be outside.